Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. And now for something completely different. Although this podcast is primarily about entrepreneurialism, sometimes I just want to talk to somebody entertaining. And boy, is Jeff Siegel entertaining. I met him about 15 years ago when I was editor-in-chief of Meininger's Wine Business International. One of our articles quoted him and he wrote to me and said, instead of quoting me, how about you commission me? Which I did. And I never looked back. He's a great reporter, a classic newspaper journalist who's moved into wine writing, which means he's more cynical and less prone to enthusiasms than many other wine writers. He also, for many years, ran a very successful blog and their newsletter called Wine Curmudgeon, where he would review interesting cheap wines and launch the occasional rant. Jeff closed it down in January 2024 after 17 years for reasons you'll hear about on this podcast. But in that time, he chronicled the boom years of wine and the bust, and he's got strong and informed opinions on what's driving the bust and what needs to happen to get things back on track. I'm simultaneously releasing this with an episode with Jess Drewy, founder of Winey Baby, who's spotted the opportunity that Jeff talks about and is having huge success. So after you've heard this one, listen to that one. To find out more about how it all works, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter at drinksinsider.com. And if you have any feedback or suggestions for guests, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. Jeff, tell me, how long have you been a journalist for?
Oh, Lord Almighty. I have to go back and count. But that's all I ever wanted to do was to be a newspaper reporter. And, you know, I did the whole thing that everybody did back then. I wrote in high school. I wrote in college. And my very first accountant internship, my very first professional job, we're coming up on 50 years writing professionally and getting paid.
And how did you get into wine? How did you go from being a gnarly newspaper guy to writing about this lifestyle thing?
Well, it's funny because when I did it, I came out of the newspaper business and I came out of sports. And at that time in the States, there were a tremendous number of people who had come out of sports to be wine writers. Dan Berger, for one, perhaps the most famous, but there were a bunch of us. And my theory always was that we did more traveling doing sports than if you just covered a city hall meeting. And so we ate out more.
It's funny you say that because one of Australia's most awarded wine writers or best wine writers, Campbell Madison, came out of sports reporting as well. Interesting. Oh, that's an interesting theory. Okay. So tell me about the evolution of the Wine Curmudgeon. Who is the Wine Curmudgeon and how did it start?
Well, now I always say this. I'm not the original Wine Curmudgeon. That was Jerry Mead. Who died many years ago. But I did not steal the name.
So I'm not talking to the original wine curmudgeon,
this,
Jeff.
I did not know
I'm talking
this.
To a fake wine curmudgeon. I wish I'd known that before I invited you on the show.
Hardly. I didn't find out about Jerry because that's how regional wine writing was in those days until I adapted the nom de plume given to me by Amy Culbertson, the food editor at the Star-Telegram newspaper in Fort Worth. Who needed she wanted me to write a regular wine review piece and she needed a name for it. And she said, what name can you come up with? And I came up with all the usual stupid names that had grapes in the title and all of that. And Amy said, oh, stop it. You're such a curmudgeon. You'll be the wine curmudgeon. And since then, and that would have been the late 90s. That's who I've been. In fact, I started writing about cheap wine. Very second wine story I ever wrote was for the Southwest Airlines in-flight magazine about great $10 wine. And the editor was so excited, she said, everybody at the magazine took the copy of the story and went out to liquor stores to go look for great cheap wine.
So you've been the wine curmudgeon for a very, very long time, and then you took it onto the blog and the Substack and you did all of that. But you shuttered it. After many, many years of being the wine curmudgeon, you closed it down. Why?
So I've been writing about cheap consumer wine, and there's no shame to my mind to use the word cheap. The industry hates it. They prefer value wine or, you know, something else. Cheap is good. There's nothing wrong with cheap. You can have cheap and quality. And I've been doing that literally since the late 90s. And so last January, I'd had the blog started in 2007, winecurmudgeon.com. And I saw which way the wine business was going. It was chasing away entry-level wine drinkers. It wasn't interested in entry-level wine drinkers. It wanted to sell $25 bottles of wine to aging baby boomers. And I wasn't making any money, and I wasn't having any fun. And the fact that I wasn't making money wasn't as big a deal that I wasn't having any fun, because I'd always had fun doing it. And I looked at it, and I said, the wine business doesn't want me anymore. I mean, they never wanted me, because premiumization and the idea that you can buy a great $8 or $10 or $12 bottle of wine made people crazy. There was no need for me anymore. The business had chased the wine business has chased away everybody younger.
I need you, Jeff. I need you. Don't be like that.
Well, thank you.
You're still important.
The wine business had chased away everybody younger than 55, and there was no reason to continue writing a blog again for a bunch of cranky old white guys who wanted to buy $8 wine because that's what they, you know, because they appreciate
that. So this is really why I asked you onto the show, is to talk about this whole question of premiumization. So we're in a place now when the wine industry is in a great deal of pain and trouble, and people are thinking a lot about, you know, what's gone wrong, how can we attract new audiences and so on. And as I understand it, for you, the problem started with premiumization. So let's talk about that. What is premiumization and when did it start?
I love the way you say that. I wish I could say it that nicely. Premiumization, that was more or less a term coined by Rob McMillan at Silicon Valley Bank, and that would have been around 2010, 2012. I may be off a little bit on the dates. And the idea that Americans were no longer drinking, they were drinking better. So they didn't want to buy two-buck Chuck anymore, which cost $3 or $4. And they didn't want to buy those big 6-liter boxes of sweet blended wines. They wanted to drink real wine. And, of course, real wine had to cost $15, $18, $20, $22. And that was the beginning of it. And the process, and everybody loved it, except for me and, you know, I don't know, four other people. The wineries loved it because there's much more margin in expensive wine. The growers loved it because they got paid more money for their grapes. The retailers loved it because there's more margin in selling a $20 bottle of wine than an $8 bottle of wine. And the wholesalers loved it.
Yeah, I think this is why I wanted to talk to you. So let's talk about this segment. So what you're saying is that at the under $12, there were options besides Yellowtail or Two-Buck Chuck. There were really interesting wines that were available. And because of the process of premiumization, people pushed those out of reach. Is that kind of the argument?
That's exactly the argument.
Okay.
If you look at Peak Pool, if you look at Muscadet, if you look at almost any of the white wines from Spain or the white wines from Sicily, Griot, my God, Griot, Nero d'Avola. And in fact, Nero d'Avola is a terrific example of what happened. To this day, I can go to Jimmy's in Dallas, a marvelous Italian grocery store, and go buy $8 Nero d'Avola that goes, wow, that's really good wine. But we don't drink $8 Nero d'Avola anymore. The wine trade got in there and they said, no, it's got to come from Mount Etna and it's got to have this soil and it's got to have this and it's got to cost $35. And so you chased away everybody who would have enjoyed $8 Griot or $8 Nero d'Avola.
When did you see this process really start to bite?
You know, it's funny. I have been thinking about that a lot, not just because you and I were going to talk, but I've spent literally, since I haven't done the blog now for a year, I've been thinking a lot about this. And I think it came when the blog, the old blog, winecurmudgeon.com, when the visitor numbers started to level off and then decline. And there were a couple of technical reasons for that. Google always changing the search algorithm. People not subscribing to blogs, but just going and looking for one thing. But anyway, but this would have been 2013, 2014. Somebody else told me they thought it was the beginning of the rise of Twitter. And so that you didn't read a blog anymore, you just read Twitter to go find stuff that you were interested in. But the more I think about it, it wasn't technical. There weren't technical issues. It was the beginning of those two generations younger than the baby boomers deciding that wine was too bougie or too boring or too expensive or too whatever. And that was, for me, the more I think about it, that's the beginning of the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. That period that you're talking about also coincides with, I remember, big efforts to try and market wine to women. You know, from about 2011 to 2013, everywhere I would go, somebody would say, here is our wine for women. And what was really striking to me, and I spoke about this many times, was how many people would offer crappy wines as their wines for women. It was never good quality wine. It was always the crappy, you know, white wine that they had lots of it to sell and whatever. There was no effort to entice people with, to entice new audiences with the good stuff.
No, and in fact, it's funny that you mentioned that, because as long as I've been writing about wine, which is a very long time, there always has been a wine for women. And it's $8 Pinot Grigio, $12 Pinot Grigio. And the great irony is, even to this day, the one attempt to premiumize Pinot Grigio has been sort of okay, Santa Margarita. But if you go back and look, retailers in the States anyway still sell a tremendous amount of $8 to $12 Pinot Grigio. I mean, God, the Kirkland Pinot Grigio from Costco. I don't know how they keep that thing in stock.
Okay, but hang on a second. So if there is still lots of this wine around at $8 to $12, why has there been the collapse in the wine market? If premiumization has been helping the process of decay, again, how do you reconcile those two things?
There's tremendous amount. Well, first off, it's hard. The wine consolidation on the producer side has made it more difficult to find quality, cheap wine. Now, this is not to criticize big wine for making crappy wine, because technically the wines are perfect. I mean, the great change, if you want to say the one great change in the wine business since you and I have been doing this, is you can go to any store in the United States, probably any store in the world, and you will not buy a bottle of flawed wine. Mm. It won't have any, it won't have any flaws. It won't be oxidized. It won't have the volatile acidity. They're all technically perfect. And that's been the great change in the wine business, because I know when I started, I'd go to the place around here where I used to go buy 3-for-7 wine, and it didn't taste like the varietal. You didn't know if it was going to, how fresh it was going to be, anything like that. But having said that, those wines are all they're boring. They all taste the same.
Yes. So this comes down to also a problem in the United States with the narrowing of the distribution channel as well. So one thing is that if you go to retail, if you go to the supermarket, you actually have a very narrow range of wines available to you. And because all of the big companies are benchmarking against each other, a lot of these wines taste the same as each other. It doesn't really matter whether you choose this one or that one. You're getting the same level of residual sugar, you're getting the same alcohol levels and so on. So in some senses, the choice is actually narrowed.
It's narrowed tremendously. I'm going to tell you what a very smart independent retailer told me just yesterday. He said 15 years ago, people would come into his shop and they would go, I'd like a $15 Cabernet that tasted like X. And he would try to find them a $15 Cabernet that tasted like X. And he said today, 15 years later, they come into his shop and they go, do you have Josh Sellers Cabernet? Do you have X Cabernet? Do you have Y Cabernet? And he goes, no. And then they walk out, because the big wine has done such a great job of marketing. They've convinced people that there's only one sort of wine that they should buy. And that's what they're very brand loyal. And brand loyalty is a very interesting thing, because in the wine business, up until these days, there never was a national brand. The only thing, some guy at Michigan State University did a study about 10 or 15 years ago, there were almost no national brands in the wine business in the States. The only brand that came close was Kendall Jackson, because its Chardonnay was ubiquitous. I like to use that word. But now, my friend said, the retailer said, they come in, they ask for specific wines, and you can't sell them anything else because they've been taught that's what they should drink.
Well, who was doing the teaching? I mean, how does a wine become ubiquitous? Good word, Jeff. How did that happen?
Well, I think there's a bunch of different ways. And as my friend the retailer said, if you are a large wine producer, pick any of the top 10, which control about Top 100 control 100%, 90%. The top 100 producers in the United States account for 90% of U.S. wine sold in the U.S., and the top 10 account for about two-thirds. So if you go into a supermarket where most of the wine in the U.S. is sold, and you go look at the Great Wall of Wine, they're going to be from a handful of producers. In fact, my local Kroger no longer sorts wine by country, or didn't last time I checked. They do it by varietal. So if you want to go buy a French wine, you got to go, you know, paw through the Sauvignon Blanc or the Chardonnay to go find a French wine. And that's a change. That's one of the most significant changes to make wine all the same. If you're a big, if you're a big producer and you go to a big retailer, because that's who big retailers like to deal with because it's easier, and you say, we're going to do your set for you, right? We're going to give you the marketing stuff. We're going to have somebody come in and stock the wine. You won't have to mess with it. And you're a Kroger and you go, God, that's more money that I can save to spend on something else.
You've often said that retailers don't understand that price matters. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
I think independent retailers less and less understand that price matters because they're not selling to people who care about price. As coming out of the recession in 2007, 2008, 2009, whenever we want to say the damn thing ended, I remember talking to a sales rep for an importer who said, I've never seen anything like this. Nobody's buying wine to cost more than $12. And I'm rubbing my hands together here, but see. And nobody liked that. Nobody made any money doing that. So, and as we chased away those two generations younger than the baby boomers, the boomers had money. Rob McMillan of Silicon Valley Bank. The baby boomers are the richest generation in U.S. history. And they're happy to spend money. And they're happy to spend money on $50 Cabernet, $75 Cabernet, $150 Cabernet. And so let's sell that to them, and then we don't have to worry about it. And now we need to worry about it because you can't get anybody younger than a baby boomer to go into your store and pay $45 for Cabernet because they're not interested in wine and I got other things.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to a California producer recently who was saying, you know, how do we get younger people interested in $60 Cabernets and $100? And I said, I'm not interested in those wines, and I'm a wine writer, you know. So let's talk about the chicken wine. Why has that been so successful when others haven't?
Oh, are we talking about Lavelle Fermé?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I love Lavelle Fermé. In fact, my mom calls it, my mom called it actually the rooster wine. And she used to, she read the blog religiously, and she was always excited when I wrote about the rooster wine because then she would go to her local retailer and go buy it. And one bottle would last her, you know, 3 weeks, but that's neither here nor there. Depending on where you buy it, it's the red, white, and rosé, $8 to $12. Sometimes less. I can get the rosé for $6.99 in Dallas. Professionally made, has flavor. It tastes like a French wine. It's not a fruit bomb. It's not sweet. In fact, the red wine, I always make fun of the scores, of wine scores in general, but Cellar Tracker, which is the thing that wine drinkers use to keep track of their cellars. So that's, you know, people who drink a lot of wine, but mostly amateurs. They can't stand wines like that because they're too tannic and they're too rustic. And let's see, a wine from a Rhone, what's that supposed to taste like? It's supposed to be tannic and rustic. It's not supposed to taste like it came from Sonoma.
That's interesting. So the connoisseurs actually reject it and ordinary people are like, yeah, it's fine.
No, well, to call somebody who uses Cellar Tracker a connoisseur, I'm not sure that's the correct I think there's a lot of people on Cellar Tracker who are wannabes. But yeah, no. But we've lost that idea that this is what wine is supposed to taste like. There was a tremendous wine writer in Dallas named Diane Teitelbaum who died several years ago. And Diane taught me a lot about wine. And she said, this homogenization, when she started, you could go to Bordeaux and you could taste a wine and you could tell who made it. Because everybody had a distinct style and everybody's wines were different. And the terroir was different. And she said, once Parker came in and on high-end wine and the idea of homogenization took hold, she said everybody, obviously a first growth is still a first growth and it still has certain things. But she said they all started to taste alike and it was much harder to tell who made what. And if you're doing that to some of the great wine in the world, imagine what you're doing to wine in a supermarket.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, many people have remarked on this. We have this idea that we have more choice because people are always talking about new varieties and old vines and orange wines and so on. But actually, in retail, things have become a lot more homogenous, partly because of benchmarking, partly because of distribution narrowing and so on. It's interesting. So the other thing that's really happened in the last 20 years is the alcohol landscape itself has changed. So when I started drinking wine in the late 90s, there was wine, beer and spirits, and the spirits was pretty traditional. That's not true any longer. The entire landscape has changed. We've got so many things from really innovative, interesting cocktails to craft beers to multiple types of beers to, you know, you name it, that there's a whole landscape of stuff out there. Do you think, how much of it has that changed things, do you think? Do you think wine can ever realistically, you know, get back to where it was in a face of all of this choice?
Choice is not a bad thing. Choice is a good thing. I did a podcast, and I'm trying to remember, but it was the idea of free enterprise. And it was about the Southern, the Federal Trade Commission here in the States suing Southern glazers for its monopolistic practices. And I said, this is the United States of America, where we're supposed to believe in free enterprise and the free market. So choice is a good thing. The more people competing, the more choices you have, the better product you have. That's Adam Smith, right? And this idea that we're going to give up wine, people are going to give up wine because they can go buy a ready-to-drink cocktail, or they can go buy hard cider or whatever. Well, yeah, if it's more interesting, if it's less expensive, if it suits what they're looking for. If I'm 30, I haven't been 35 in a while, but if I'm 35 years old and I got a couple of kids and I got whatever passes for a job these days, and I got to worry about whatever passes for an economy these days, and I want alcohol, what am I going to do? Go buy an RTD? Or am I going to go waste my time, go to a real wine shop and have some guy lecture me that I got to go buy a $75 bottle of wine to get back to the point of the guy in Napa? What can we do to get young people interested in $60 wine? We can't. They're not. Why should they be?
All right, let's talk about restaurant wine and wine prices. So post-COVID, there's been a lot of cutting down of restaurant lists, or as they use the word curated, but they're pretty expensive as well. It's always been a truism that wine brands are created in the on-trade. What effect is this having?
You've hit, I think, on the great unrecognized, unwant-to-be-recognized disaster of the wine business. We can talk about the anti-alcohol movement. We can talk about the demographic shift. We can talk about all of that stuff, and I'll drop a name here. Warren Winiarski, Stag's Leap, Judgment of Paris, best Cabernet, told me years ago, the way to sell wine is to sell it in a restaurant. He said, you sell your wine in a restaurant, people will go look for it at retail, and then they'll be surprised at how much less expensive it is, and they'll buy it. So what the wine business did, what the on-premise did, the on-trade did, coming out of the recession, their business never really recovered. For a bunch of different reasons. And everybody ignored that. So they just kept raising prices. And we're now at the point where a glass of wine in some restaurants is going to cost you $25. Why would anybody want to pay $25 for a glass of wine?
Can I tell you a story? I think I have told you this story, but it's my opportunity to say it publicly. So at the end of 2022, a friend and I went to Washington. So being a journo, I travel my holidays, I do it by tax deduction, and there was a journalism conference. So I decided to go. So we're in Washington, and you know, you get discounts on hotels and stuff. So my friend stayed at the Grand Hyatt, which is where the conference was, and I stayed at a less expensive but still quite nice hotel in the sort of center of Washington, right? So it was within walking distance of a whole lot of important things. So you'd think, you know, if you stayed somewhere like that in London or Paris or you know, a major capital city, even Canberra in Australia, you would find nice wine bars. And if you went into the restaurants, you'd find quite nice wine lists. And we found it impossible to have good wine. Everywhere we went, including the hotels, they served us bulk wine. Now, I know what bulk wine tastes like because I go and judge the bulk wine competition in Amsterdam, and I know when I'm tasting 70 cents a litre. And it was this faceless, nameless, you know, rosé, which I was ordering. And so eventually I switched to gin and tonic. And, you know, everywhere we went, the wine was woeful. So eventually we went to Georgetown and we went to a wine bar, and the wine started at $100 a bottle. So afterwards, when I was telling people about this, of course, a lot of my friends are in wine, whatever. They said, why didn't you ask us for recommendations? We could have told you where to go. And I said, but you shouldn't have to have that kind of social capital to be able to have a glass of wine. And the other thing is this crappy, nameless, faceless wine was expensive. You couldn't get it under $15 a glass. And I swear to God, it was stuff that was about 70 cents a litre. So I just started drinking gin and tonic. And we got on the plane and my friend Polly said to me, now I understand why there's a problem with wine in the States.
No, that story is actually the perfect example of what happened. So here's the deal with the restaurant business. The restaurant business in the United States has always been based on cheap labor and cheap real estate. Cheap labor is the people in the family working at it. And cheap real estate is the family owns the location the restaurant's in. And that model still is sort of the model that the restaurant business in the States is based on. But it's irrelevant anymore. It doesn't make any sense. There is no cheap labor anymore, right? You got to pay your employees health insurance. You got to make sure that their tips come out to some sort of minimum wage thing, depending on, you know, which state you're in. And rents, my God. Before the pandemic, you know, restaurants in Manhattan couldn't even afford to be on the ground floor. There was talk you're going to have to walk upstairs to the second floor because rents were so expensive. In San Francisco, the same thing. So to keep people coming into the restaurants, you can't jack up the price of chicken. Everybody knows what chicken costs, right? You can charge $25 for a chicken breast entree. You can't charge $50. But you can charge $50 for a $13 bottle of wine. And so that's what they've been doing to make their revenue goals. In fact, we just did, there was a big webinar Trump's going to bring back his tariffs and we'll finish killing off the U.S. restaurant business because the profit now in most restaurants that are fine dining or close to fine dining or that serve alcohol, the profit comes not from the food, but from the alcohol. And once tariffs come in and people stop buying alcohol as much as they did, they're not buying all that much anyway, that will put a real nail in the coffin of the restaurant business.
Yeah, I want to come back to tariffs in a second because they are the terrifying thing that everyone's worried about. But I just want to continue on this topic of people not drinking because, of course, what you're talking about the United States is singular. It has the three-tier system. It has the narrow distribution. It has all of these things. When I was saying Washington is very different than when you're in London. But the slide in wine has been international. It's a global problem. So there's something else going on than just, you know, these drivers that we're talking about in the United States. Do you think, you know, so the explanation that wine people always give is they'll always say something like, we're too snobby, we're too complicated, we haven't, you know, told our story properly. And I've heard all of that since I got interested in wine in about 1998, and it didn't cause problems for the boomers. What do you think? Aside from those things we've talked about, do you think there are other problems with wine?
I think to look at the slide in wine in the rest of the world and to compare it to the United States, I'm not sure that's going to accomplish anything. The reason I say that is I think the only country that you can compare it to is perhaps Great Britain, because those are the only two countries in the world where there are a significant percentage of people who don't drink at all. In the U.S., depending on which Gallup poll you look at, it's 30 to 40%. And Britain has also had its anti-temperance movements over time. If you look at Germany, if you look at Italy, if you look at Spain, if you look at France, the decline in wine drinking there, I think, is completely different. Because, for one thing, it's still a cultural thing. They're drinking less wine in France, but they're not drinking. Yes, you know, I've seen the numbers and that there are fewer people drinking and, you know, more people abstaining. But drinking is still part of the culture. Wine with dinner is still part of the culture. That hasn't gone away. You just won't have six glasses of wine with dinner. Maybe you'll only have three. So the French police, when they arrest you for drunk driving, you'll be sober and not drunk. Here, it's always been, alcohol has always been something that is not part of the culture. At least wine has not been part of the culture. beer when I was a kid, spirits before that. And so wine makes this great advance in the wine boom from the late 90s up until the beginning, just before the pandemic. And everybody assumed that would go on forever. And I don't think people understood that the pinnings of it, the underpinnings of it were so fragile and so narrow.
So do you think the United States is just reverting to its historic norm?
Well, that's what my friend Dave McIntyre, the former wine critic of the Washington Post, said. He said, this has always been a teetotaling country. And there's a reason why the only country in the world that's not Muslim has ever had prohibition is the United States.
Oh, no. Canada, Finland, and Iceland all had prohibition.
Well, the Canadians had parts of not drinking, but you could still buy booze in Canada when you couldn't buy booze in the States.
But to go back to this question of the wine trade is always saying we've made it too complicated, we've made it this. I always struggle with this because on the one hand, at a introductory level, at the supermarket level, I think actually it's not that difficult. It's varieties. Here's the Pinot Grigio. Here's this. Here's that. But as soon as you get above that level, as soon as you stop talking about Prosecco and Pinot Grigio and Cabernet Sauvignon, you are in a very complicated and difficult world. And I'm not sure how you can simplify that. What do you think? Do you think the wine trade needs to speak to people in a different way?
I think it needs to decide that it wants entry level wine drinkers. Again, I think that's when the conversation that you and I have had about this in the past, the conversation we're having now, entry level wine drinkers want to know what to have to drink that they won't spit out and gag on. And it's nothing more complicated than that. And so that's what I literally got down on my knees and thanked whatever deity exists.
Did you actually get down on your knees, Jeff? Is this comic exaggeration?
I said I almost did.
You almost did. Nice save there, Jeff.
When rosé became popular, I thought, my God, here it is. Here's an entry-level wine. Here's the gateway wine that the wine business in the United States has been looking for 50 years. And so what's the very first thing the wine business did? They complicated rosé and they charged more money for it. And now if you look at rosé sales, hand going down again. If you want to have new drinkers, you have to make it accessible to them and say, this is a pink wine. It has flavors of this. It's not sweet. And then if you want to worry about terroir, if you want to worry about what slope the sun faces on, if you want to worry about how many the lactic acid and how much pH and all of that, for your $150 Napa Cabernet, then let them get to that point, but don't scare them away immediately. That's when we talk about complicated. It's not so much that it's complicated; it is complicated, but you're scaring people. There's a reason why baseball can be complicating. I'll use cricket, even better example. There's a reason why cricket's complicated because unless you grow up with it, you have absolutely no idea what's going on. Yeah. And I've tried. I used to be a sports writer, and I've tried to understand it, and I can't.
Okay, let's go back to, you know, when I came into the picture, there was Robert Parker, of course, but something else happened, which is we had Yellowtail, which was at the time, it was actually a very good quality wine for the money. So there was a grape glut in Australia and they were able to offer, and also the Australian dollar was at that point was 50 cents to the US, no, one US dollar bought two Australian dollars, right? So they were able to offer a $15 wine quality for about $7. Now, that all went wrong when the Australian dollar went up and the production grew and the quality, you know, didn't and so on. But those original Yellowtail wines were actually fantastic value for money. And the second example we have of that is the Two Buck Chuck, which is that, you know, there was a grape glut in California and not all of Two Buck Chuck was great, but there were some batches which people would go out and recommend because it was made of really high quality grapes. So you get this sort of gateway wines, which were actually well made and good quality. People don't remember that, but they were at the time. Do you think that now that there's another grape glut where people are begging for somebody to come and take away their grapes, that it's likely that we'll see something like that again? Or is the moment for those sorts of brands gone?
The moment is gone, and because the wine business has changed so much. The very first question I asked, and I did a lot of asking and a lot of reporting, when the grape glut first started showing up, whatever it was, 18 months ago? Are we going to see another two-buck chuck? Because two-buck chuck was created in the depths of the last bad wine, the last wine downturn, which was in the early 90s, because there was so much fruit out there that was not being sold. And I asked everybody, because I'm thinking, this is the United States. We're entrepreneurs and all that crap. Somebody's going to go out there. They're going to go buy some bulk wine. They're going to make a great $8 wine. They're going to call it whatever. It's going to have a clever label, right? It's not going to have a castle on it. It's not going to say Chateau something or other. It's going to appeal to young people. And I can count on this hand with my fist closed how many times that's happened in the last 18 months. A couple of things have changed, or so I've been told, one of which is all of the people who had that entrepreneurial spirit 30 years ago are dead or retired or aren't interested in it.
Okay, so this really is a curmudgeonly conversation. No, they're all dead. All right, and there's no new entrepreneurs.
I was told that. Second, okay. The business has changed so much that there's nobody who understands that's what you need to do to sell wine if there's bulk. I mean, basically what's going on with the bulk market now is I'm making $100, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, oversimplifying a little bit here. But this is kind of what I've been told. I'm making $100 Cabernet. I'm going to go buy grapes, quality grapes, because there's such a glut that I don't have to pay as much for, and I'll get a bigger margin on my $100 Cabernet. I'm not lowering the price of my $100 Cabernet. The bulk grape market in California is at a standstill. I've got a friend.
It is internationally as well. It's interesting. This is so interesting because on this podcast, I've interviewed a couple of entrepreneurs. One is Marion Leitner-Waldman, who makes Archer Ruse. And I've got an interview coming up with the creator of Winey Baby. And all of those have said, what I did was I offered really good quality wine, but in packaging that people want. So it's in cans or it's in bag and box or it's in, it's in labels with peel off stickers and stuff like that. And they're all experiencing huge success. And I just think, well, why isn't everybody else doing something like that?
There's a bunch of different reasons. One of which is if I go to my local retailer and just use Archer Ruse, and I've interviewed her too. She's a very sharp person.
She's amazing.
If I go to my local retailer and look for Archer Ruse, it's almost certainly not going to be there. It's, again, the distribution problem in the States. Second, there's this great contradiction between the baby boomers who buy wines and bottles with corks because that's what we do. And to get them, because they're still a key market, right? To get them to go buy wine in a can so that a retailer will carry it, that's a big deal. That's difficult to do.
Are you saying if we could convince baby boomers to drink wines in cans, that would bring everybody else in the market too?
We have to convince retailers there's a market for something other than in a bottle.
Yeah, interesting.
Go look in a shop, a good wine shop, or
coming back to this, take advantage of the grape glut. I cannot believe that in America there aren't entrepreneurs ready to take advantage of that. But I think if I've understood you correctly, what you're saying is even if they did, they'd have an uphill road trying to get it into distribution.
Yeah. Oh no. Almost certainly. Thank you for, taking my rant and putting it into something people can understand. If I'm a wholesaler. I'm selling, and the wholesalers, right, the top 10 wholesalers control 90% of the market or whatever it is, and the top two wholesalers control close to half. I want wine. I want a product that I can put in a lot of big retailers, and I don't want to have to mess around with it. And that rules out something that's not 500,000 cases, and it rules out something that's not a bottle that can be shipped in the supply chain system.
All right, so who's the villain at the piece of this? It's a wine trade that raised its prices and stopped the interesting wines being affordable. It's a distribution bottleneck that's just too narrow. It's restaurants having costs, so loading them all onto the wine list. Have we left anybody out?
I will tell you that there is a Texas, recently retired Texas singer named, singer-songwriter named Robert Earl Keen, and many great songs, but one of Robert Earl Keen's best songs is The Road Goes On Forever and the Party Never Ends. And the wine business coming out of the recession saw they could raise prices. And I say the wine business as this generic thing. Saw they could raise prices and that the baby boomers would keep buying until the last one was dead. And that would support everything. And that's whose fault it is. The good times would never end. And we're just going to keep doing this and doing this and doing this. It's the same way, you know, when the automobile came in and everybody said, oh, well, that's just a passing fad. We're always going to need horses. Because you know what? We've used horses for 10,000 years. And horses have always been the most important mode of transport in the history of the world. And if I hear one more person tell me, Felicity, we've always drunk wine. We're going to keep drinking wine. It's not going away. I want to ask them why. And saying that it's been there for 10,000 years is not a good reason.
I'll tell you another story. I had an investment banker ring me up and want a conversation about wine and health. But she said, should she be advising people to buy investment-grade wine? We had a long talk about it. And she said she'd grown up in a part of Italy where the fur trade was really important. But she said in her childhood, the fur trade collapsed because nobody touches fur anymore apart from oligarchs in Russia. But, you know, maybe one day furs will come back, but they probably won't. And that was a trade that's existed since before civilization. You know, that goes right back to the Neanderthals. That's before Homo sapiens. And she said it just collapsed. It's gone.
Things change. And the point is not trying to figure out whether change is good or bad, but it's figuring out how to adapt to it so you don't get left behind.
All right, so now we're piling on the misery. Let's talk about tariffs. What happened when the Trump administration put tariffs on wine last time?
Sales didn't collapse as badly as they did for whiskey, Scotch whiskey. But they were hurt very badly. And I know for a fact, because I have people calling me up all the time going, what can we do to stop these tariffs? And I talked to one marketer, very smart person, who said what scares her about the tariffs is that there are people in California who think it's going to be good for the wine business. And because some of these people in California are convinced that American consumers will not buy if a $50 French red Bordeaux goes up to $75 or whatever, that they're going to switch to go buy a California $50 Cabernet. And I mean, I don't know what universe those people live in, but it ain't the universe that the rest of us live in.
Yeah, all right. So let's finally talk about neo-prohibition and wine and health. Now, you saw this a long time before the wine trade started talking about it. Can you tell me about the history of this reemergence of temperance?
It's funny because when you and I were talking about doing this, and I went and looked it up because I knew it was a long time ago. I didn't realize it was that long ago. In fact, let me see if I can find it here, if I can find the damn thing. So on the blog in May of 2013, the Federal National Highway Transportation Safety Board, which is, that's what they do. They try to keep the roads safe. They decided they would propose lowering the blood alcohol limit in the U.S. to 0.05 from 0.08. And about the same time, the Centers for Disease Control, and this is way before, and you would know this better than I would, but I'm pretty sure this is way before the World Health Organization got on the anti-alcohol bandwagon, said we need to start taxing alcohol more. We need to restrict the number of alcohol licenses available for both retail and restaurants. And we need to increase the penalties for drunk driving. And so, Felicity, this is 2025. This is almost 15 years ago. So this is nothing new.
But why, in your opinion, has it got louder lately?
Well, I think a couple of things happened. I think the road goes on forever and the party never ends. And everybody thought prohibition was over and done with. That's number one. I think number two, the World Health Organization has made their decision that alcohol is as bad as smoking. With dubious scientific evidence. I think that's made a big difference because they carry a lot of weight, particularly with national governments. And the third thing is that in the United States, at least, we thought we'd settle this prohibition thing. We thought we'd settle this prohibition thing in 1933. We tried it. It didn't work. If you didn't want to drink, that's fine. And if you wanted to drink, we'd sell you alcohol.
So people tell me that in the United States, sales collapsed in the 1980s, that there was a health movement then, there was Mothers Against Drink Driving. And it came out of that because of things like the 60 Minutes program on the French paradox. But do you think it would have come out of that slump anyway, that this is just a cycle that happens?
I think, well, that's, as I said, that's what Dave McIntyre told me, and he's a very smart guy, so I have no reason to doubt him. Coming out of the slump in the 80s, with the 60 Minutes thing on the French paradox. But what we also have to remember is that Mothers Against Drunk Driving didn't say, they weren't anti-alcohol. They didn't care, because I've discussed this with them at length. They did not, their agenda was not everyone should stop drinking. Their agenda was don't drive drunk. Let's start enforcing drunk driving laws.
But it did, sure, but it did have an impact on the alcohol market.
And it did. And it, no, I'm not saying, but that's the, my point is that's the difference between what they did and what's going on today, in which all drinking is bad. In fact, one of the great successes in the United States is that drunk driving deaths have, since that time, again, hand going down, drunk driving deaths in the U.S. have consistently gone down, and they're at a fraction of what they used to be. The other thing that happened, and the other thing that happened in the late 80s and early 90s was the introduction of good, cheap wine, what were called the fighting varietals.
Mm.
And that was Fetzer, and that was Sutter Home. And what they did is they went and they made Chardonnay at an inexpensive price that tasted like Chardonnay. They made Cabernet at an inexpensive price that tasted like Cabernet. And Frank Priel, who was a legendary wine writer at the New York Times, I've still got this piece someplace, wrote a thing saying, Americans can now go out and they can go buy pay $5 or $6 for a bottle of wine that they know is going to taste good every time. So instead of maybe buying wine once or twice a month, you'd buy wine 3 or 4 or 5 times a month. And these were the baby boomers. And they suddenly realized, hey, wait a minute. Wine tastes better with dinner than scotch does. And wine is more interesting than beer is, because back then we were at one of the points of big beer way before craft beer, and all beer tasted exactly alike, mm-hmm. and beer sales were kind of not what the big beer companies wanted them to be. So I think that would have, regardless of 60 Minutes, that would have sparked a wine boom just because there was innovative quality wine.
So is that the answer again? Innovative quality wine that doesn't cost an arm and a leg? Is that the simple solution to all of this? Even though all of the things we've talked about, the distribution bottleneck, the restaurant pressure with prices.
10 years ago, I think it would have been. It's not today because we've lost the two generations younger than the baby boomers. And so that's Gen X and the millennials, the older millennials. And if somebody in the wine business can find a way to get the younger millennials and the Gen Zs interested in something that they're not interested in, let me know and I'll go back to writing consumer wine and I'll do everything I can to help.
Right, Jeff. Although you are the wine curmudgeon and you've been very curmudgeonly, this is a podcast about entrepreneurialism. We have to have a ray of light at the end. Where do you think the opportunities are in the wine market?
Oh, the opportunities. Having said what I just said, you want a ray of sunshine, I'll give you the ray of sunshine.
Yeah, I want a ray of sunshine. I want a blast of sunshine, Jeff.
The blast of sunshine is, if somebody in California can figure out, given the cost of production, which I'll admit it isn't easy, if somebody in California can figure out how to make a great $12 wine with a cute label that doesn't have a critter on it, but it's fun, that appeals to somebody who's 25 years old and wants to take it to a party, then we got a chance. But that's up to them. That's their entrepreneurial spirit. That's what they got to go do. I suggested this 15 years ago. It's a true story. I said, let's do Wine Writer Red, Wine Writer White, and Wine Writer Rosé. I said, there's got to be enough bulk. You can make a great $10 wine. You put a cranky wine writer, man, woman, whatever, on a typewriter like this. I said, we'll sell a gazillion of them.
Well, yeah, but just the novelty of going, what's that thing on the label? And somebody going, it's a typewriter, Sonny.
See, that's what I mean. You got to make it different. No more chateaus, no more critters.
All right. On that note, thank you so much, Jeff Siegel.
My pleasure. It's always good to talk to you, Felicity.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.